you want really good coffee to take on your next adventure, use CS Instant Coffee. You can find out more about them at csinstant.coffee.
Some nights, going through the moon cycles out there, there was obviously no moon at times. And when it was a clear night, the Milky Way was just absolutely jumping out of the sky. You know, there was no light pollution. You know, I could see these huge bands of stars.
This is the Adventure Sports Podcast, where we hear stories of adventure from every corner of the planet. We interview all sorts of folks who are using their sport to explore the world around them and give you the inspiration you need to get out there and have some fun. If you're on an adventure right now, somewhere out in the world, I hope it's going well for you, and I hope this show brings a little inspiration to your journey. And for everyone else that's listening, I hope it brings inspiration to your life. And this particular episode is from March 30th, 2017, with Gavin Hennigan, about an adventure, something I've always wanted to do, which is row across the Atlantic. Ever since I heard that concept, I've always been intrigued by it, just because it seems so dangerous on one hand, but also so simple on the other. You know, those two things can obviously go hand in hand, simple and dangerous. There's something about just being out there totally alone. You know, when you're alone on a boat in the middle of the ocean, you are really alone. In fact, that's probably the most alone you'll ever be, because even when I'm out in the woods here in Colorado or back home in Florida, I'm not too many miles away from the next person, because inevitably somebody's going to be camping or, you know, hiking somewhere near me within 20 miles. But there are, you know, when you're out on an ocean, there's a chance you're the only human within hundreds and hundreds, if not 1,000 miles or more. I mean, there's a lot of boats out there, but still, you are a long way from someone else. Hope you enjoy this episode. Hope you get some inspiration from it. Like I said, continue sharing the show with folks. You know, if you know someone that needs a little inspiration in their life and wants to do something, show them the show. We've got a lot of great episodes out. But enough of me yakking. Let's get into the episode.
All right, you guys know this guy. He is Gavin Hennigan, and we've had Gavin on the show back in episode 159. He was here to tell us all about his Lake Baikal trek. It was a frozen Lake Baikal, and he did 440 miles across that lake, solo and unsupported. So he was on our show to talk about that. If you want to hear that one, go back to episode 159. It's from April of 2016. But since then, Gavin has been up to a few cool things, and I wanted to have him back on to talk about that, and we will dig into it later, but that was his solo Atlantic row from the Canary Islands off the west coast of Africa to Antigua in the Caribbean. So we're going to dig into that a little bit later, but before we do that, Gavin, we've had a ton of listeners added to our show, so I wanted to go back and kind of revisit what got you into adventure to begin with. So first of all, welcome back to the show and happy St. Paddy's Day to you.
Yeah. Cheers. Cheers, Travis. Good to be back on the show. Happy St. Patrick's Day from a very wet and rainy Ireland.
That's no surprise, is it?
No, not at all. Not at all. Yeah. So, yeah, I suppose, obviously, as you said, there's some new listeners. So just going back to how I ended up getting into adventure and all the travel that I've done. In my teenage years, I got quite heavy into alcohol and drugs, and had a really roller coaster few years. Ended up using heroin, living in squats and getting in all sorts of trouble. Culminated in actually living in a furnishless apartment in West London after leaving Ireland for being on the run from getting in trouble with drug dealing, living in this like little apartment with no furniture and just sleeping on a mattress on a ground with, there was no curtains on the windows. I had black bags just blacking out the windows, trash bags as you guys call them, and just waking up in the morning and just getting stoned and going back to sleep again, not even knowing if it was night or day. It was just like a dark little hole. And I remember even hearing the letterbox going as as the post came through there, the mail, and just it used to fill me with fear because that was like reality. That was having to deal with life, and I was just so afraid. And it was a really tough few years, but I ended up going into rehab at 21 and managing to get clean. And remarkably, I've stayed clean for the last 15 years. So it's been an incredible journey. I think after about 3 or 4 months of being clean, there was a friend of mine who was also on the straight and narrow, and he was also trying to stay clean, and we both decided we were going to try surfing for the first time. So he pooled his money together and I pooled my money. We didn't have very much at the time, and he bought a board and I bought a wetsuit. And surfing in the west coast of Ireland is an experience to behold. So we took off down the coast in the middle of November to try this new sport. This is nearly 15 years ago, so it hadn't really been happening in Ireland. And we jumped in and gave it a go. He tried it first, and then I tried it afterwards. Had to get into a wetsuit that was full of urine. But just after that, I suppose it sparked something in me, and that was to, you know, get out and do more things and try all these sports that I kind of always wanted to do when I was drinking and using drugs. But, I just didn't have the self-esteem, the belief, or the drive, really, because I was just so battered from using and drinking all the time. So, after I got clean, adventure saved my life, really, just in all forms. And I've never really stuck to one thing. I've surfed for many years. I've snowboarded. I've mountaineered. I've snowboard mountaineered. I've ultra running. Long treks like we just spoke about there, Lake Baikal, and in the last couple of years, started rowing and got into ocean rowing and managed to just row across the Atlantic just recently.
You just like that. You just decided to get a boat and just enter into a race and take a 50-day trip across the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah, not as simple as that, but right. Yeah, it was actually my first rowing race, so I'm quite proud of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you went from these dark days in life as a teenager to kicking it and being 15 years free of it and becoming a rower, obviously, ultra runner, snowboarder, mountain climber, split boarder. So you've done a lot of things. So you obviously have found that adventure sports can dig you out and hold you out of those addictive days. And I think that I love that story, and I wanted you to go back into a little bit just so our new listeners can hear it, because I think hopefully that can provide a little inspiration for some others who may be listening in that are finding themselves in the same place that you used to find yourself in.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good message. And yeah, I think it's just important to highlight it. Yeah. Just as in, if it just helps somebody else, if one person is listening now and they're, in a similar situation, or they know somebody. And yeah, I suppose some people remark that, that I've like swapped addictions, and I don't really like that term, because now, I've got this passion, and it's just such a great thing to love the outdoors like we do, and to be able to go out and do it, and just, I suppose, really just, give up your life for this sort of passion. And I think that's a really important thing, to really just follow it no matter what. The idea with me wanting to row across the Atlantic was sparked by reading a book. And, I work in adventure. I was a commercial diver, after I got clean and sober, and spending a couple of years sober, I went to Australia and I learned how to be a commercial diver. So I spent 10 years, like we spoke about in the other show, working as a saturation diver all over the world, doing like heavy construction at 600 foot, 700 foot in West Africa and Middle East. So I've had this amazing life, and it was all going according to plan up until probably about 18 months ago, when I was made redundant because the price of oil dropped, and I had all this money saved up, and I was kind of at the point in my life where I thought I probably should do something sensible, like buy a house or really think about my future. But I did the complete opposite. I actually decided I was going to gamble my life a little bit, and I decided that I was going to buy an ocean rowing boat instead of buying a house. So that's what I did. And yeah, I spent, you know, the best part of 18 months learning to row, training to row, and, you know, entering this race called the Talisker Whiskey Atlante Challenge, which is, you know, billed as the world's toughest row. It's a race, 3,000 nautical mile race across the Atlantic. It's got solos, pairs, threes, fours in it. And I basically, yeah, sacrificed absolutely everything to do this race. And yeah, I just finished it on February the 1st, so not so long ago.
Wow, what an amazing feat. So you decided to fund your boat yourself. I mean, most of us looking in would think, well, of course he found a sponsor and the sponsor has provided his boat. But this is, you bought this thing outright, you own it, and this is, for all intents and purposes, your house?
Exactly. Yeah, I suppose that's, you know, I saw it as an investment into myself and into my future, and I didn't quite know what that future was going to be. And I think that's an important point as well. I just said to myself, right, well, this is either going to open doors or, worst case scenario, I go do something else afterwards. And you know, I've been trying to do like a bit of public speaking and stuff like that, so I'm sort of just about able to call myself an adventurer as a job title at the moment, because since the row, things have kind of, you know, started to happen. Doors have been open for me. But yeah, the lead up to it was very tough. I kind of naively assumed that I'd be kind of getting sponsors left, right and center. But it was a tough sell here in Ireland, you know, for companies. And I actually ended up funding probably about 90% of the row myself. And but going forward now, I'm starting to see a bit of light at the end of the tunnel, and starting to get more interest. You know, but that stuff takes a lot of time. You need to build up kind of profile, social media, and stuff like that, and get the right connections. So it's starting to work out slowly but surely.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it sounds like you're on your way. Good for you. So you had told me on the we did a catch up, you know, a Where Are They Now episode, and you had told me on that episode how this idea was born to row across the ocean. You just alluded to it a few minutes ago, but you were reading a book, but where you're reading that book was down in your, or in your decompression chamber, right? So tell me a little bit about that, about the inspiration to decide to row.
Yeah, so just, you know, to give people a little bit more information, the diving that I did, the type of diving is I worked in the oil industry, and it's, you know, it's called saturation diving, and basically involves going inside a small chamber and then being pressurized inside that chamber and then living in that chamber for up to a month at a time. And then we go from that chamber into a diving bell, which takes us from the diving support vessel that we're on down to the bottom. We get out, we go to work for 6 to 8 hours, we come back, and we just spend our few weeks going up and down, working away. And then at the very end, we spend up to maybe sometimes 9-10 days decompressing. So to come back from these depths, it takes a long, long time. You know, it can take usually around a week, if not more. And it's a very kind of small enclosed space, similar to a little boat. And yeah, it's not the nicest place to be, but it earns the money. But I find myself really daydreaming and coming up with ideas and looking for inspiration within that chamber for me to go out and do stuff after I finish work. So, you know, I spent all these years working as a diver, and then I'd, you know, come out and I'd have a couple of months off, and I'd take off to like Alaska split boarding, or I'd be like down in Antarctica, or I'd be doing some crazy ultra race. And yeah, I got this idea to row the Atlantic from reading a book I just picked up in the airport on the way to work. It was a really cool book called Salt, Sweat and Tears by Adam Rackley. And it's about him and a friend who rowed the Atlantic in the same race. But it also gives a really good history into ocean rowing and the first men who did it. And, you know, just the full background into it. And yeah, it just really sort of caught my attention, the whole thing. And I had this little kind of spark inside me, and it was like, well, maybe I could do that. And I suppose it was just kind of born out of that little spark that I said, yeah, let's look into this. And I think I signed up before I could really start really think it through. And I think I remarked a few times during the year last year, when things were getting pretty hectic, and more money was just being spent on various different things I needed for the boat. I said to myself, if I had known about all this beforehand, I probably wouldn't have signed up. But I think that's the essence to adventure. You know, we get this spark, we get this idea to go and do something cool, and we need to just do that, or we need to stay true to that little inspiration. And it's just after that that all the fear and the doubt and the sensibilities come in, when we think to ourselves, well, no, I can't do that because X, Y, and Z. And there's always going to be an excuse for the reason not to take on an adventure. And there's always going to be doubt. And like, I really try and focus on the inspiration and the spark, and to try and stay true to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you alluded to not liking the term addiction when it comes to your adventure, and I completely get that. I like that you choose the term passion instead, but I have to think that, or I have to wonder if there's still a link, you know, with the dark days and the addiction that you dealt with narcotics and alcohol. Do you think that had any role in allowing you to take the jumps and the gambles, you know, the big leaps and the gambles, to do something like buy yourself a boat instead of buy yourself a house and jump into it before you really know how it's going to end up? Do you think that part of your personality lends itself to that? Or do you think you developed that ability because of what you had dealt with? And it's more of a, hey, I want to live life and it's time to invest in myself. I mean, which way do you see that?
Yeah, that's a great point. Great question. I think it's a bit of both. It's definitely on the side of, look, you know, I've been given the second chance. I didn't slip through the cracks. I managed to get clean and sober. You know, there's a lot of what ifs. You know, coming from where I came from, you know, I was suicidal just after getting clean, and I didn't really like myself very much. So I suppose, like, I didn't really want to settle for mediocrity. You know, if I was going to get clean and stay clean, I wanted to try and live my life to the fullest. I wanted to try and have all these cool experiences and just keep having the notches there. I think where the addiction comes into it is probably a little bit in the case of that I always want more. And that's kind of tough. You know, like, I remember remarking that when I got across Lake Baikal, you know, it was actually this day last year that I finished on Lake Baikal. It was St. Patrick's Day, 2016. So, you know, I crossed 440 miles on my own, dragging this, 125-pound sled. And I got right to the end of this barren little town called Nyngarsk on the very tip of the northern end of Lake Baikal. And I sat in my little sled, and I was just saying, wow, I did it. And then I started looking, kind of, I could just see there was like a frozen marshland. And I thought to myself, I could probably go a bit further. And then I had to like reel it in and go, hang on a minute, he just did like 440 miles.
Right.
In like a very, very quick time. You know, I actually ran out of food in the last few days. I was eating less than 1,000 calories. It was, you know, I was pretty beat up at that stage. But of course, I was always like, oh, you could probably do a bit more. But so, you know, I recognize that's probably the addiction side of me. And I just got to keep an eye on that. And I suppose it's just about awareness, you know, that I just need to sort of go, okay, you know, you've done enough. Give yourself a pat on the back. And, you know, yeah, you can plan some other stuff. But yeah, you don't need to do any more miles.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I have to wonder, I'm no psychologist, but I do not have an addictive personality. I've never, you know, gotten into smoking or drugs or alcohol to the extent that, you know, I ever had a dependence or felt like I needed it. But when you talk about getting to the end of your trek across Baikal and looking at the horizon and thinking, I could keep going here, I think we all have that. I have to think that we all have that. When we get to the end of such an adventure, and your adventures, I mean, mine pale in comparison, and I still get that feeling like I don't want to go back to reality, so to speak. I want to keep going here. And I don't know if that's an addiction or you're just so in love with what you just did and your time out there and what you've experienced, that how could you possibly want to stop it and go back to reality, you know? So yeah, so yeah. I don't know. I don't know if that's part addiction or just simply innate in all of us as human beings.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I suppose it's just, I remember my father he passed away actually a month before I left, and you know, it was a tough time, obviously just before the row. But previous to that, about a year and a half before that, he was really ill, and he was actually about to pretty much pass away, and he'd all but given up. He had a lot of mental health issues, and he was very bad manic depressive, and he was very, very low, and he actually wanted to die, like, as in that's how bad his depression was. And I remember he didn't pass away at the time. He managed to hang on for a while longer and things got a bit better. But, you know, I remember people saying to me, oh, isn't he so determined? You know, they kind of remarked at his sort of resilience. And, you know, I didn't see any of that, you know, in him at the time. I just saw him wanting to go. And what I did see, though, is I just saw life. And I suppose I just took a step back and I really thought to myself, life wants to live. You know, we just see it all around us. You see like a little weed going through a crack. You know, it's an undeniable fact, you know, philosophically speaking, that life wants to live, you know. And I think for me, when I go out and do these things, and I feel like that I'm tapped into that, you know, and that's the life coming through me. And you know, I suppose if I'm cooped up in an office or I'm doing something I don't want to do, I find that bit is crushed inside me, you know. And I think, yeah, maybe that's what it is with the adventure stuff, that it's that passion's coming through, that life is really wanting to express itself in those forms.
Yeah, yeah, right. Well, and that's obviously what keeps you turning back, you know, to the addiction, to the drugs and alcohol. So, man, I mean, I hope that anybody listening in that may find themselves in a similar situation can derive that inspiration from your story and from the stories of others who have similar tales to, you know, to set out, go find your adventure, and you know, and hopefully you too will find yourself on the path of trading addiction for passion.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Time for a quick message break. CS Instant Coffee is definitely the best instant coffee I've ever had. In fact, just out of convenience and how good it tastes, I decided for the last year I've been taking it on every single adventure I go on, from backpacking to bike tours, just from convenience sake. It's really high quality and it keeps me from having to take a bunch of other equipment out in the woods. But it's not just for going out on adventures. My wife actually takes some to work every single day with her. She takes a couple packs to refill her coffee mug as a teacher. She doesn't have a ton of time to have to, you know, make fresh coffee all the time. So she just needs a little hot water, can pour the coffee in, and she's ready to go for her next class and not waste a lot of time. So if you're crunched for time in your job, I would definitely suggest giving it a shot, because they have been huge supporters of the show for the last year. And I really appreciate everything they've done for us. And it would mean a lot to me to go support them. So if you're interested, go to csinstant.coffee and support those who are supporting the show. It would go a long way. Thank you. All right, let's get back to the episode.
Okay, so you've decided to buy your boat and you're entering into the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge. Now tell me about this race. There's not a lot of people racing in it. I think you had 12 teams, and you had already alluded to there were groups of, you know, solo rowers, and then teams of three and teams of four. So tell me a little bit about the race, and where you started, where you ended up, how long it took, and just kind of the whole goal.
Yeah. So it's been going on in one form or another since 1997, on and off, kind of every couple of years is randomly organized. And it's been going on now for the last few years pretty solidly, as there's a company called Atlantic Campaigns that organizes it. So it's starting to really pick up. They used to have it every 2 years, and this was the first year that they had it, you know, yearly, and it's hopefully continuing on. So it's starting to become a bigger and bigger thing. It's a 3,000 nautical mile rowing race, which is quite ridiculous. Lasts, you know, anything between 35 and, you know, 90 days for some people. So it's a pretty stretched out race. Begins in La Gomera in the Canaries and then goes across the Atlantic to Antigua. So it follows the Tradewind route, which is the classic sort of sailing route. It's probably the most straightforward kind of ocean crossing that you can get, because of the trade winds that blow for this part of the year. So from about October through to April, May, the trade winds blow. They're pretty consistent. So you've got a decent enough wind behind you. And then over to Antigua in the Caribbean, and it's out of hurricane season. So it's a good time to do it. It's still pretty hot, which isn't a bad thing for someone coming from Ireland. But so I set off from there on the 14th of December, 2000, just gone. And I spent 49 and a half days on my own rowing. And out of the 12 teams, I actually came in third. So there was only four solos, and I managed to come third overall. So the two four-man teams beat me, and I managed to beat, an American team by about an hour and a half. There was a trio behind me, and then a few other teams of twos and threes and fours. And there's actually a guy still out there. There's a guy who broke his rudder, and he's about 100 miles to go. He's in a pure class boat. So there's two different types of boats in this race. There's one called a concept class, and then there's the traditional ocean rowing boat. So I had a concept class boat. So just without any rowing, it goes faster anyway. It catches a bit of wind. The main cabin is quite big. It catches a bit of wind, and also has a flat bottom hull. So it really surfs very well in the ocean swells. So that was something that I had a bit of experience in. So from my surfing background, so I quite enjoyed that bit about it. Managed to get up to 15 knots at one stage, flying down waves.
Wow.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of the bit of information on the race. But yeah, it was an incredible 49 and a half days out there.
Well, I think it's awesome because you had said, I asked you how long you expected that to take, and you said your goal would be the 50 day mark, and you beat it by half a day. How cool is that? Congratulations.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Look, it was tough because early on in the race, we had a really good start. Straight off the bat, we had some really strong trade winds, and we were absolutely flying for the first sort of week, 10 days. And I was averaging over 60 miles a day. And then I was thinking, oh wow, I'm gonna like break 45 days here. And then there was this kind of real funky period in the middle when the winds died down and they came from kind of every other direction. And then we had a lot of currents that kind of came up. So there was, you know, a lot of, you know, there weren't major currents, but you're in an ocean rowing boat, it affects you. Even a 0.5 knot current mm-hmm. would definitely affect you. So between that and, you know, the weird winds, it slowed me right down, and I actually had a 60 mile lead on the next team behind me, another trio of guys, South African guys. And then the American guys started to really catch up after that. They had a kind of weird start. They had a lot of power issues, and you know, they just had a while to get into their groove. But once they did, they started to really catch. And then I think about 3 weeks from the end, they just every day they started to take miles out of me. And then the winds came back in 7 days from the end, a few hundred miles out, and they were within 10 miles of me by then at that stage. And I spent the last week just trying to hang on, and I managed to hang on. They actually were an hour and a half, 2 hours behind me in the end. It was less than 10 miles. It was a real cat and mouse battle. But yeah, I in that middle period, I didn't think I was going to break 55 days just based on my averages, but things really sped up at the end. And, you know, the reason why I was able to go as fast as those guys, you know, most people just see it as, you know, they've got more manpower and there's only one of me, which is a very valid point, but my boat was a lot lighter. And then when the winds really kick in, what happens is I get a good push when I'm resting, and that makes all the difference, because they have guys rolling 24/7, whereas obviously I have to rest. But I really pushed the boundaries for myself in regards to sleep deprivation out there. I was really on the edge of what was possible for myself. I was probably, some days I was rowing 17, 18 hours, and I was only sleeping 3 hours a night. So I really, really, really pushed hard. And, you know, that last week, I just had to kind of take it up a notch, which I didn't think I could, because I was already pretty beat up after, you know, 6.5 weeks of rowing. And I just, you know, the guys pushed me really hard right to the end, and I actually rowed 14 hours in the last push was 14 hours straight, because they were really catching me, and I just wanted to try and hang on to that third spot and to break the 50 days. But, you know, so yeah, it was incredible. They actually did really well in the end, because they were the first trio to row the Atlantic, so they came out of it with that accolade, even though I did pip them. So
well, that's awesome that you did pull it out and beat them in, because, you know, I get the lighter boat, and it allows you to flow while you're taking a break. But at the same time, I mean, just one guy rowing that entire time, and in a 14-hour stretch, I'm sure none of those guys put in a 14-hour stretch, and they got to rotate out. But for you, you can't, you know, how could you possibly let them overtake you? So it just drives you, you know, further and further into it.
Yeah, it's just the competitive kind of part of me took over. And yeah, it's because I've been in third place for, you know, most of the race. I think it was after the first few days I got into third. So, you know, I kind of thought to myself, oh, I don't want to lose it. But then a part of me was like, well, it's okay if they beat you because you're a solo guy. People are still going to respect you. But yeah, look, I just decided to get pretty dogged. And yeah, it was an incredible experience to finish in Antigua. We finished at nighttime, and I remember coming in, and it was just it's very hectic because you're trying to make it into this kind of harbor, this kind of bluffs on either side of it, and you know, you're seeing land for the first time in 50 days, but you want to kind of celebrate, but you're still really focused on the navigation and making it in. And I remember coming in and rounding this headland, and the wind kind of swung around from the other direction, and I immediately got this smell of vegetation and land, which I hadn't smelt in 50 days, and it was a very bizarre kind of blast to my senses. All I could smell was sea air and BO. I had a few swims, but so just coming in, and then you finish in English Harbor in the south of Antigua, and it's just full of super yachts, and these guys are setting off their horns, and there's just people all around you with, you know, shouting and screaming. And my sister was there, and my family and friends, and they'd flown over, and it was just a hugely overwhelming experience. There was a big crowd gathered, and you know, to finish at the dock there and just celebrate with the Irish flag. And I remember stepping off the boat and nearly falling over because I didn't have my land legs. It was I spent all this time on this little unstable boat that I couldn't actually properly stand up in. The boat literally moves around that much all the time that you can't really stand up unaided. So as soon as I put my feet on dry land, I nearly fell over, and I spent the next 2 days wobbling around the place looking like a drunk person.
Yeah, I'll bet. Yeah, you probably have to crawl around a lot. Well, I can relate to the not having your land legs. But what I can't imagine is experiencing on that small of a boat. I come from a sailing family. My parents had a 43-foot sailboat, and spending, you know, a week out on that thing and then stepping off to the dock the first time, I would even feel it then. But, you know, you're talking 50 days on a boat that's getting rocked around a lot more than that. It's got to be a complete blow to the senses to have to try and walk on land, and you have all the horns going off, and you have all the crowds, and you have the smell of the trees and everything coming off the island that, you know, after 50 days of just hearing water lap up against the side of the boat, and that's pretty much the only sound you get other than maybe a passing plane, then yeah, that's got to be a complete blow to the senses.
No, it was crazy because I didn't see very much out there. There's just a whole lot of nothing out there, and I suppose that was part of the allure to me, that it was just this great vast open space that I wanted to go out and just be in. And yeah, it was incredible. I had some really cool moments out there. There was the times when the sun was setting at nighttime. I mean, I saw 50 sunsets and 50 sunrises, you know, every single one spectacularly different. You know, as I rode in the morning, I was looking east, looking at the sun coming up, and then in the evening it was setting behind me. And I remember it used to illuminate the clouds in the far distance, you know, as the sun was setting, and it used to give the place such a huge expanse. Like the clouds just looked like they were hundreds of miles away, and it just made the place seem even bigger. And then some nights, you know, going through the moon cycles out there, there was obviously no moon at times, and when it was a clear night, the Milky Way was just absolutely jumping out of the sky. You know, there was no light pollution. You know, I could see these, you know, huge bands of stars, and I could even see stars almost at eye level. You know, I had never seen that before because there was no light pollution or no light on the horizon. So right. I used to see in the evenings, just as it was getting dark, I start to think it was a ship in the distance. I was like, no, that's actually just a star coming up over the horizon. So yeah, it was incredible.
Yeah, it's got to be an amazing experience that you alone will be able to take that to your grave. And there's so many people that will never get that experience. And for you to have experienced it and be able to take it with you forever, I mean, that's that in and of itself is worth the entire thing, I got to think.
Yeah, and that's a good point. You know, that sort of perspective that I tried to have out there, no matter how bad it got. Like, I think the the whole sort of PR thing with this row is obviously it's the world's toughest row, and a lot of the media that you'll see is, you know, all about that. And, you know, I think it is tough. Don't get me wrong. It's not an easy thing to do, but, you know, I just got to put this into perspective. I paid willingly to go out there. You know, a lot of people in the world are living hand to mouth, and, you know, this is a privileged thing that I'm doing. So really, no matter how bad I think it is out there, you know, I've got my food, my supplies, I've got 90 days of food, you know, I've got my water maker, you know, I've got food, I've got water, I've got a bed, you know, really, you know, all I've got to do is row. And yeah, you know, it gets very monotonous at times. It's boring. It's good, it's bad, whatever. But I suppose it's just having that perspective that, you know, to try and enjoy it and experience it, because I am very, very lucky to be doing that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I did want to point this out because I've already established you're a pretty humble guy and you probably won't bring it up, but I understand that you crushed the previous Irish record of 118 days. So by doing it in less than 50, I mean, that's a huge difference. And you've also set the record to be the fastest solo competitor in the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge. So congratulations on those 2 points.
Yeah, and I suppose, yeah, the media definitely picked up on that. And just to clarify as well, you know, I was in the concept boat. Sean McGowan, the guy who did it in 118 days, was in a traditional boat. So, yeah, I mean, it's the fastest overall, but I don't want to take away from what Sean did. And it is a contentious point within ocean rowing because the concept boats have only been around for a few years. And, right. And you know, there are some purists out there that you know, kind of would frown a little bit at people trying to claim that they're the fastest boat, you know, whereas, you know, it's a different class. And, you know, I just wanted to be clear on that myself. You know, I was going out there, you know, 50 days is long enough for me. I didn't really fancy, you know, making it any harder. Like, it's funny that I was thinking about it the last day, you know, when I went across Lake Baikal, you know, I was like on foot and I met a lot of people that were skating it and I met a lot of people that were biking it, and every one of them remarked to me like, what are you doing it on foot? And it was always about, I said to myself, well, yeah, I suppose I was kind of being a purist in that sense, you know, but I'm not 100% purist in regards to ocean rowing. I definitely enjoyed the additional push that I got from the winds, and the capability of the boat and the surf was absolutely amazing. Like I said, being able to get up to 15 knots down some of these waves makes it a really fun experience.
Yeah, I'll bet. Well, good for you for clarifying that. It was definitely honorable. So how do you deal with the mental attitude while out there? Do you find it difficult, or is it a matter of you just convince yourself, you know, look, hey, you're out here doing something amazing. Look at the sunrise, look at the sunset, look at the stars. You know, is that how you balance it out, or is it tough, or do you have bad times?
It's tough, you know, rowing an ocean is definitely a metaphor for life. It's you've got the whole experience and you have it in heightened, you know, the whole experience can be heightened, the emotions can be heightened. So, you know, that sort of perspective stuff can only work sometimes. Other times you're just down and you just got to be down, and that's just part of it. I think for me, it's just about trying to accept that, yeah, look, you can't be, you know, trying to convince yourself of positivity the whole time. I suppose this is where I think a lot of people go wrong in the modern world, that it's just this real, like, hardcore, like, I must be positive all the time. And, you know, I go out there and I'm not this steely-eyed adventurer where I'm, you know, always up and trying to stay positive. You know, there's times that I'm down and that's just part of the experience. It's, you know, and there's times that I'm slamming the oars off the side of the boat and I'm having to stop rowing and just go in and have a lie down, and, you know, things are kind of going a bit haywire. So I suppose it's just being aware that that's happening and just be okay with it, because I think that if you try and really try and change that, it just takes up more energy. So I think overall, mentally, it is a huge mental battle. It really is all about the mental side of things. People ask me all about the training and stuff like that. And, you know, the training is important, but I think, you know, physically, you know, you can go a lot more than you think. And it's all about the mind being kind of in control of the body and in control of the situation. So I think for me, what I just did is I broke things down a lot. I worked in a sort of shift system. I ended up doing 3 hours on, 1 hour off. So I started, you know, sort of early in the mornings, around 5 a.m, and I did 3 hours on, 1 hour off. And, you know, I just focused on those 3 hours, trying to get into a good rhythm. You know, as I sat on my rowing position, I had a deck repeater on the back deck, and I had a compass. So I was watching my heading, I was watching my course over ground, I was watching my speed. So I was usually trying to, like, keep my speed maybe above 2 knots, 3 knots, depending on what the winds were doing. So I'd really try and focus on that. I might be listening to a podcast, just keep it in that period, and then just really look forward to that hour off, you know, that I was off for that hour, that I was going to eat something, I was going to have a nap, and then just kind of starting all over again, and just doing all that day to day, and you know, just trying to not have too much expectations, because I found that out there at the end of the day, I can really think to myself, you know, okay, I'm going to do 60 miles today, and then halfway through the day, I've only done, like, you know, 20, and I'm already kind of a little bit depressed. So it's just trying to lower my expectations all the time, because I think what I found out is that really the ocean decides what happens. You know, even with the forecasts that I got, you know, I had a really good weather guy. His name's Levin Brown. He's an absolute legend of an ocean rower. He spent probably more time than anyone in a rowing boat. So he did my weather, and, you know, I spoke to him most days, you know, as the person who I was closest with the most on the row. And, you know, there was days even when he, you know, couldn't get an exact forecast, because what would happen is there'd be a, you know, a sort of, say, 15 to 20 knot forecast day, and it looked, you know, I'm thinking, okay, I can do 50, 60 miles today, it looks good. But then what happens, you get these squalls that come through, localized sort of thunderstorms, convective storms. And they'd kind of, you'd get a really good push for maybe half an hour with the wind. And then what would happen is they kind of blow the wind out. And then you'd have just this kind of funky kind of, you know, doldrum effect for a few hours. And that could last up to 9 hours. And then if you add in a little current on top of that, you're down to, like, barely doing a knot. So that's incredibly frustrating, because you're kind of, like, relying on this forecast. You're thinking, oh, well, I should be doing this. And then you're thinking, well, hang on a sec. You know, this is what's happening right now. So at the end of the day, it was always coming back to, well, you know, the boat is generally pointed in the direction I want to be going. I am moving. It might be as fast as I want to be moving. So I just need to keep that going. And it was a constant battle in mentally between all that sort of stuff and a real day-to-day thing, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah, I bet. I do hear a common element in there, in that these, you know, people that are doing long adventures like this find that they can get through it mentally by basically giving themselves little treats throughout the day, or maybe at the end of the day. And, you know, like you were saying, it may be, you know, just the rest and the sleep may be enough, but some people find a little piece of, you know, the best piece of candy or something that they really drives them, you know, or some little psychological treat. So I think just literally taking it one day at a time sounds like what you do. Just get through it. You're going to get through the 50 days.
Absolutely, yeah. On the candy thing there, I had 90 days of food. I'd have like 5,000 calories a day in these sort of packs. So I had 4 expedition meals, and then I had like these 2,000 calorie packs full of like nuts, you know, dried fruit, candy. And I actually didn't bring that much candy. I probably bought like, 15 to 20 big bags of it, and I had it all in these different packs. And I ended up, after about a week, I ended up raiding through all the looking for this candy, because I was just really had that sugar, you know, I wanted that sugar, those sugary things. And you find different bits and pieces. And I had a lot of food, like 90 days is a lot. So I didn't have to have, be as disciplined as I would have had to have been, say, on like Baikal or any of the other stuff. I had an abundance of food, and I actually ended up emptying out a lot of food towards the end, because I was so desperate to try and stay ahead of these the American oarsman team, that I was ditching weight wherever I could. So there was a lot of freeze-dried chili con carne and spaghetti bolognese gone to Neptune, the sea god. Yeah.
The fish were eating well in those last few days. Yeah. That's awesome. So yeah. You also had a link to raising money with this trip. So tell me a little bit about that. Two different organizations.
Yeah, so I've been partnered with a charity called Cancer Care West for previous challenges, and it's just a local charity here in Galway. They help people, you know, families of people with cancer who might be able to afford it to come to the town from the rural areas to get treatment. And they have like a place where people can stay and their families. So yeah, I've been doing stuff with them, raising a bit of money. And then I partnered with this other charity for this in particular, which is, it's called Jigsaw. And it's a mental health for young people. So it's like they have drop-in centers all over the country, and it's just for anyone aged between the ages of 16 and I think 23, 24. Just a safe place to come, talk about your problems. You know, if you have a drink problem, just get pointed in the right direction. And it's just a really cool service for young people. And you know, I didn't have that sort of stuff when I was younger, and I was lucky to not slip through the cracks. So I suppose it fits really well with my own personal story. And I was really proud to be supporting those guys and have them along for the ride, and they've been really great so far, and we are going to be working closely with them in the future. So yeah, the charity side of it's really cool. I didn't raise like as much as I thought I'd raise. I actually was more focused on the awareness, which was really cool. So we got a lot more you know, through my own story of sharing that, like I spoke about there with you. Just the idea that, you know, it's okay to talk to people, you know, and it's really important that we're responsible for our youth, you just think like what really went wrong in society that I thought at 19 years old that suicide and alcohol and drugs was a solution. You know, it's really scary when I think of it, you know, because, you know, I suppose it's different in American culture. We're a little bit more reserved in Ireland. I think we don't really tell our children that they can do stuff, and I suppose we'd like to take a leaf out of your tree. You know, that it's important to tell people that they can do things. And you know, I wasn't told anything like that as a youth. You know, I grew up with like quite low self esteem, low self worth, and you know, evidently I ended up wanting to, you know, nearly kill myself because of it. So. You know, and now I've achieved a whole bunch of stuff, you know, all these adventures, which is cool. But, you know, I didn't think at the time that was possible. So I suppose now it's about, you know, trying to pass that message on just to young people that, you know, so much is possible, be it, you know, whatever it is you want to do. It doesn't have to be all the stuff that I do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the awareness is the most important thing. And I'm glad you brought it up. I just interviewed a guy that rode. He had similar problems with drugs and alcohol in college, and he finally kicked it, and he wanted to give back to the organization that helped him through it. So he rode a 50cc scooter from Colorado all the way up to Alaska, a 4,600-mile ride on a little tiny scooter. And nice. His goal was the same thing, to raise money, but also to raise awareness and let others know, you know, kids know that if they find themselves in these shoes, that there are places they can turn and they can talk to people about it. And I think that's so important, because you're right. There's a, you know, big part of society just wants to keep things secret. And, you know, we're the same thing over here. People just don't talk about it. And I think a lot of people think that they're alone in their struggle, when if they just open their eyes and talk to a few people, they'll realize there are a lot more people around them that are also dealing with the same or similar struggles. And that's all it takes, is just talking a little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really cool. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about the plans to row back. Now, you know, a few listeners thought maybe Gavin has reached his pinnacle of this. He's actually sending his boat, Dorian, I think is what you call it.
Actually, we pronounce it. It's a tough one. It's an Irish. It's actually the name of my niece. And yeah, if you look at it, you wouldn't think it's pronounced Durin, but it's that's how it is.
Durin. Okay. Yeah, I was going to ask you where it came from. So yeah. You're sending the boat back to New York City, and you have plans to row that back home to Galway again.
Yeah.
And so that's what this coming up in June, pretty soon here. So. Why? Yeah. I mean, it's just a matter of, I got this boat, I got to figure out something to do with it, or is there more purpose to it?
A little bit of both. I think I had the idea to, I suppose, row home would be the term, and to come back to Galway. Just had it, you know, before I started, and I didn't say it to anyone. I was like, oh, yeah, I can't really tell anyone, this is a bit crazy. And then I said to myself, right, well, let's just kind of deal with one side of the Atlantic first. So, you know, I kind of was halfway through the row, and I kind of asked myself the question, you know, would I be up for doing? And I kind of was like, yeah, I'm kind of enjoying this experience. And I said, yeah. And then I waited until like a really bad day when I had like, you know, bad sort of wind direction. The waves were smashing me inside the boat. I wasn't really getting anywhere. I was just kind of getting knocked all over the place. And again, I asked myself the question, and it was still a yes. So I was pretty much decided sort of about halfway over that I was going to ship the boat from Antigua to New York and row her across the North Atlantic. And I suppose for me, it's just a really, really, just seemed like a really cool, adventurous thing to do. It just, you know, so the history of ocean rowing is that the two first Norwegians, Harbo and Samuelsson, rowed from Battery Park on the tip of Manhattan, and they and they ended up in the UK. Just as a silly back in 1896. So it's just it's where it all started. And then there's also another meaning aside to it, in that there's a huge connection with Ireland and New York, and particularly Battery Park. It's where all the immigrants came ashore. It's where the famine ships came ashore. And I suppose I'm just going to draw that line a little bit, and then obviously come back to my hometown where I'm from. You know, the North Atlantic. I grew up on these shores. You know, I swim every day, even though the water's freezing at the moment. I wouldn't call it a swim. I jump in. The water's probably like not even 40 degrees at the moment. But yeah, I go for a dip in there. Like I surf. You know, I've rowed all around these coasts and stuff. So it's just a huge kind of meaning to me. And you know, for everyone at home, it's really cool as well. Obviously, it's a little bit more tangible than me coming directly back to Ireland. So. Yeah, it's to do it in 12 months as well, to row both ways in 12 months is kind of ridiculous. It's been done before by a French guy. But yeah, the North Atlantic is a whole different beast altogether. The trade wind route has been rowed, I think, 130 odd times solo. The North Atlantic route has been rowed 15 times. So it's
wow. You know,
drastically different. And that's because obviously it's a lot stormy up the side of the ocean. This is where the low pressures generate. We've got one rolling through right now. You know, we've had sort of 40 knot winds today, and you know the seas are pretty big. So yeah, I mean it's a different ballgame altogether. Then you've got the added extra of coming off the Grand Banks. There's all the fog there. There's the North Atlantic drift coming from the Gulf Stream. There's like eddies of current there and stuff. So it's yeah, it's definitely a tough proposition, and the fact that I've just got off the ocean to go back out there is a little bit daunting, but I'm definitely up for the challenge.
Yeah, it should be pretty exciting. I did interview a guy by the name of Peter Bray way back. Yes. Peter was back on episode 93, I guess, and he had rowed over from Cornwall, so I take it you're familiar with him.
Yeah, I did listen to that episode. I actually forgot to tell you, I had a ton of these podcasts. I'd listened to them on the Atlantic, so you've been in my ear, buddy.
I'm sorry about that. You might have gotten it done in 40 days if you'd not been listening to me.
yeah. No, I definitely used plenty of the episodes to, you know, get me through different shifts here and there. So
good.
Thanks for that.
Glad to hear that. You wouldn't be the only adventurer out there that we've interviewed that we find is out on their next adventure listening to more of the Adventure Sports Podcast. So I'm glad you said that. Thanks for the plug. But anyway, back to the Atlantic. Yeah, he had met up with a massive storm, and I guess that time he was coming over, and you could probably remember the story better than I. But he was coming over and met up with a massive storm with other crew members and ended up having to save a guy after the boat had overturned. But yeah, I guess it can get pretty nasty up there by comparison. So I hope you are safe and things go well. I can't wait to follow this one along.
Yeah, I'm kind of up in the safety. I'm bringing an extra rudder. I'm bringing a third set of oars. I've got two sea anchors, which are these giant parachutes that you drop into the water. And they come out, you let them out like on 70 meters of line, which stops you from going backwards in the middle of a storm. So you can kind of hang off this sea anchor in a storm. So yeah, I'm taking lots of additional stuff. I'm putting in an extra solar panel and an extra battery because there's less sun up this side of the Atlantic, as I well know. So yeah, just extra bits here and there, and just trying to be as safe as possible for this return route.
Okay, good. And this one is completely solo. You don't have any other racers out there. There's no a boat, you know, just kind of checking on things. This is just you heading back to Galway, right?
Yeah, so it's it's completely solo, unsupported, unassisted crossing. So yeah, like I'll have a weather guy again, and hopefully I'm looking to get some support around New York. My boat's going to be in Liberty Landing Marina, just on the New Jersey side there, just a stone's throw from Manhattan. So yeah, big shout out to all the American listeners to come down and come down and see me off, maybe and hopefully the end of May around that time. Yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, guys, go follow Gavin. He's got his website up now. It's gavinhennigan.com. It's GAVANHENNIGAN.com. He keeps you up to date. He's got a blog there. Of course, all the social media, you can find him as Solo Gav. It's SOULOGAV. And you can find him on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter by that name. Go follow him. Keep an eye on what he's doing. If you're around the New York area, run down to Battery Park and help give the guy a good good American send-off. It's going to be an amazing trip, and I can't wait to watch you do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a million. Yeah, and yeah, definitely, if any American friends, adventure friends are there, definitely come see me. Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. All right. Well, good deal, Gavin. I wish you all the luck, and be safe out there, and we will follow along, and we will root for your success and your quick return to Galway.
Excellent. Thanks, Travis. To be back on the show.
Thanks for your time, and again, happy St. Paddy's Day.
Nice one. Same to you.
All right.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Studies show that 100% of everybody in the world wants to curl up indoors and do nothing because it's so darn cold out there. That's why many people are turning to Bombas, whose pillowy plush slippers and warm merino wool socks have been said to be the most comfortable in the history of feet. Bombas products have been found to boost coziness by up to 1 million percent. Okay, enough fake statistics, but could Bombas socks and slippers really be the cure? Go to bombas.com/audio and use code AUDIO for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com and use code AUDIO.